The byways and highways will get rolling. Thank you for coming back. It's always encouraging when people don't leave. Okay, we're ready for part two of this talk. We're going to talk about a biblical alternative that we need to give our kids. And again, this is a little bit scary. And if you're a teenager, please remain calm. I'm not attempting to marry you off in the next 5 minutes. But I'm talking about a paradigm shift in the way we look at relationships and the way we look at dealing with males and females together. The biblical alternative is to begin to love your future spouse before you know them. It doesn't always work, but sometimes, most of the time, we can begin implementing this and doing this. But it takes a rethinking of the minds to see how this is practical, not just something whimsical or stupid. So we'll try and work that through for you. It begins with a selfless commitment. Because at its root, would you be surprised if to hear, and maybe you wouldn't, but in practicality you might, would you be surprised to think that sex is not primarily for your pleasure? Is that strange to anybody, or everybody good with that, or we okay? If you were to read anything in the modern education world or in the modern news media or in terms of how things are presented, that's exactly the reason for sexual activity. But love is rooted in a selfless commitment, not when I want, but in what God wants. So I need to begin thinking of things along those lines. Then that follows, sexual purity then must be positive and worthy of self-control. The reason I put it this way is because if all we talk about is don't, and it's bad, 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 and what happens is then, you know, we mess around with it and we find that it's good, good, bad, good, good, we tend to fall into the idea of saying, well, maybe I should be involved in this. Sexual purity has got to be something which is based on a positive thing. Yes, there's a negative. I'm going to turn away from it because of all the damage that it's done. But I'm also going to realize that God has the best thing possible for me. And a lot of our worry, whether it's sex or other issues, day-to-day life, the struggles of life, have to do with the fact that we're not really convinced that God has the best thing for me. Or if I do what He wants, that somehow that's going to be good. But this idea has to permeate all the way through us in terms of our day-to-day life. That's why I want us to be talking about it all the time with our kids. So sexual purity must be positive and worthy of self-control. So if you work this thing through with your children, and then you go to have the talk that Tim urged you to have, you might actually have the kids that are jumping up and down in the play field, as opposed to an armed rebellion camp, as those photos so powerfully depicted. So we need to be positive about this. Biblical self-control means acting on the belief that God has a better way for things to do things than you do. Seven years ago, April 1st, my wife was diagnosed with brain cancer, a particularly lethal form of it, glioblastoma. She was given 6 months to live, and we went to Duke, and she lived 3.5 years. And there's a sense of, you know, there was all this point ideas of what we were going to do, what she was going to accomplish. And what she came to grips with immediately is that God is a better script writer than she was. That had to filter into my life to say, God is a better script writer than I am. He didn't make a mistake. He wasn't on coffee break. Well, if it's true in that situation, then how about if God says sex belongs in marriage, maybe God has a better understanding of that than what you and I might want. So we have to build something that's encouraging for our kids and not just talk about the negative. Because if you talk about something that's negative all the time, what's most likely going to happen? You can do it. And you don't paint it with the wonder that God desires for it. It's not just no, no, no. It is God has something really, really special. Now, parents, this is why it's hard for you. Because if it's not really, really special to you, then maybe we'll have a hard time communicating that to our kids. So that means if it's not really special for you, do we just give up and go home? Or maybe it's time to begin to work with the kind of counseling help that's available here. Begin to rethink your marriage and say, maybe I've been thinking about sex in a way that the culture thinks about sex. And maybe that's why it's not special. Again, borrowing from what Tim said, we have to do an inventory. The inventory has got to be, is my thinking about sexuality in line with what God says it should be? I have to trust that God is a better scriptwriter than I am. So it's not just enough to emphasize the negative. Okay. There must be a positive reason to see why marriage is the best and only place for sex. And you've got to believe that in your heart before you can begin to give that to your children. And if it's not there in your heart, don't expect your children to buy into it. You know, your kids have a checker, which is not necessarily electronic, but it's probably the most profound checker on the planet. Your kids have the ability to be hypocrisy checkers. And they know when there's hypocrisy coming out of your mouth far, far faster than you do. And we have to have humility to realize that. That's what we've got to be emphasis. We're going to talk about our kids about being repentant. We've got to be repentant. If we're going to talk to our kids about being obedient, we've got to be obedient. If we're going to talk about our kids about the need of grace, we have to understand our need of grace. So we have to give them something positive here. And if you're not really sold into the fact that God's plan for sex in the context of marriage is the very best possible thing that could ever happen, then you're robbing your kids of something beautiful. Now, God's grace is such that he's able to overcome our shortcomings. But I don't have the liberty as a parent to bail out of that. I've got to give them what God says right now. Going back to this whole idea, begin loving your future spouse before you know them. But you've got to have a positive context if that's going to work. Natural is not always good. Obviously, we see that in our culture. And that's one of the things that's going to play about and helping our kids understand why they need to plan and love their future spouse even before they know them, instead of doing what's natural. You begin by showing the danger of the fallen traditions that are in this world. Colossians 2:8 warns us, don't be taken captive by the hollow and deceptive philosophy of this world, which is based upon human traditions and teachings. If your thinking about sexuality is primarily influenced by things in the world instead of a biblical influence, then you've been taken captive. And being taken captive is no fun. I don't care how nice you make the settings, trappings. It's not a good thing to do. Our culture does not allow, for example, I'll give you a contrast. Our culture doesn't allow natural anger to run free, right? Somebody gets mad and wants to go shoot somebody because they're angry. We still lock people up for that. No idea how much longer, but at least right now we're locking people up for it. Because we're going to restrain something which we acknowledge is natural. You can't go beat the living daylights out of somebody just because you don't like them. When that anger wells up, you can't yell and scream at someone and expect that to be beneficial. Everybody has certain curbs about that, even the non-Christian culture. But with regard to sex, whatever is natural, greed-driven, is revered, no matter how bizarre. Paul mentioned the Katie Couric interview. The recent issue of National Geographic extols different cultural practices all over the world where mutilation and horrible things that are done to meet sexual designs and principles of that culture. And we're okay with that because we don't want to be judgmental. And today, we don't want to restrict anybody's ability to do what they want sexually because that's being judgmental. So we open the door. We revere people making whatever choices they want to make about a natural instinct that needs to be brought under the control of God. But we're very inconsistent because we do somehow want to restrict other natural instincts like anger. Unbiblical sexual attraction and arousal produces pornography, lustful fantasies, dreams, masturbation, broken marriages. And by broken marriages, I don't mean just the ones that end divorced in the divorce. I'm talking about the ones that are ongoing, where mom and dad are still together and miserable and unhappy with each other, and somehow just trying to fight through it for the sake of the kids. But you know who's got that figured out before you do? Your kids do. This view of sexual attraction that I talked about, this unbiblical view of sexual attraction, is something that's out there, and anything and everything can turn me on. We've got to fight against that, and it produces this kind of garbage in lives, and it destroys people. And sometimes the death is very slow. I've looked across the counseling table from a couple. This is just a composite, but it's by no means unusual. For a couple that have been married 30 years, and they are just flat out miserable. The husband's doing pornography. The wife is shattered, but they soldier on. And then they come to me because their kids are out of control. How can we stop our kids from doing this, that, and the other thing? And the first thing I have to tell them is it starts with you. We're not going to be able to get to your kids unless we get this with you. Or we can wait, and 5 years later your kids will come see me. You don't want that. I've probably done more weeping in the counseling room than any other place because these situations are so broken. And you see generations, parents, children, grandchildren, all caught up in this ugly thing because they've been buying into what the world says. So when you want to talk about these things with your teenagers, the stakes are really, really high. You don't want them entering into marriage with this idea that somehow they can live this way. These sinful patterns, they carry over into marriage, and they depersonalize sex in a quest for self-gratification. These patterns bring hurt and devastation into the marriage and the relationship and the lives of children. It is huge for you to begin having a positive understanding about sex and sexuality right now so your kids know what's up and then you have the credibility of not perfection. I haven't met anybody yet that fits the perfection filter. But I have known people that are repentant. I have known people that know the grace of God. And that's the kind of person you want to be. And that's the hope that your kids are going to need. Because if your kids were struggling with this stuff and you just tell them we're not going to do this and we're going to take your computers away and you're not going to have them for 10 years, which I've heard people give that solution, and the kid knows that that doesn't mean for more than 10 minutes. But still, it's what the parent does in exasperation and frustration and all the rest of that. We've got to bring this positive pattern right back into the relationship. So self-control then is a gift to the spouse that you're going to marry, or if you are married, it's a gift you can give to your spouse right now. It's not too late. This is why we have to understand that sexual arousal and lustful thoughts are not simply biological urges that cannot be controlled. This is important for people who are married, people who are not married, and for those who will never marry. Even if someone has the gift of singleness, even if someone is going to remain single, they're still going to go through puberty, and they're still going to have to deal with sexual issues, and they're still going to have to buy into the reality that sex is for marriage. And if you're giving that up, at least give it up, with, eyes wide open and realize what you're walking into and build that relationship with Christ and make it more special, as Paul urges you to do. So these thoughts are crucial for everybody. Paul urges you, walk by the Spirit and you will not gratify the desires of your flesh. We see those on little posters in our home, nice little wall placards. But I have a pastor friend of mine, he says he calls those things placosis. We have the nice little sayings, but we don't live by them. We need to live by it. And I walk by the Spirit by making Him and His Word the most precious thing in my life. We seek the fruit of self-control, seeing that gift, that self-control become a gift for the person that you will marry or the person that you are currently married to. And this is a precious gift. How much money are we supposed to spend on a diamond ring? Insane amounts of money. How much money are we supposed to spend on weddings? More insane amount of money. I used to do photography, as Ed mentioned. I used to do weddings, a fair amount of weddings. And this is back when I was younger. $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 were not unusual amounts of money to spend on a wedding. Because they valued this, between the wedding ring and the wedding, this is thought of as gifts that last, what, a day? And then it's gone? This idea of learning self-control for the glory of God is the most precious gift that you can give. There needs to be time spent planning and thinking for that instead of years thinking about what kind of wedding dress is going to be worn or what kind of ring is going to be given. We need to value things in terms of the way God says they should do. So again, we're not just talking about self-denial. We're talking about honoring Christ. And I keep on returning to this thing, and you'll find out if you were counseling with me, you'll find out that I'm not very creative either. I say the same things over and over and over again. Are you interested in loving Christ, or are you interested in serving yourself? My fourth child, second daughter, both of my girls have type 1 diabetes. Got it in early teens. And neither one of them have seen that as something that is a detriment to them. They've seen it as something that God has given them, and they're to function well. So my oldest daughter has her master's in piano performance, and she is currently a cop. She was the first insulin-dependent police officer in the city of Columbia, South Carolina. She rough and tumbles in the whole business with that because she wants to do what's right. But she also wanted to honor Christ. My second daughter, successful, driven person, she and her husband, hers is the more severe, so it was not wise medically for her to have children. So they're adopting a child. And their first child, they've had him for a year now, and they got him from Kyrgyzstan. Amazing story of God's grace. A little 7-year-old boy. But my first daughter was replaying to me a conversation she heard going on between Geneva, my daughter, and the son. His name was Tristan. And Tristan had disobeyed. And so Geneva sets Tristan down, and she said, "Tristan, who's in charge?" And he goes, Mommy and Daddy and God? And Eva says, yeah, right. And then she says, Tristan, who's not in charge? Me. Is there any more basic truth for you to learn in your entire life than that? But how much do we value it? I tell that to council days and they look like I'm an idiot. What has that got to do with anything? And I'm not particularly afraid of that, so I said it has everything to do with the mess you're in right now. Do you want to keep going? Or do you want to acknowledge God? If all you've got to offer is self-denial, and I'm not downplaying the importance of it. I'm not downplaying the importance of discipline. And at the risk of getting myself in trouble, I think my wife and I probably caused global warming, okay? So I'm all for discipline. But if you don't have this compassion and love of God and this basic thing that this is God's world and not mine, you don't have anything to offer. Even if you go by covenant eyes. Because they'll see through that in a heartbeat. And don't misunderstand me. I am 1,000% behind what Tim said. Like I said, I'm just trying to come in underneath him and be supportive of what he was saying. You cannot view self-denial as something which is just simply this negative thing I have to groan and endure. And too many of your kids think that obeying God is this awful, gruesome task of just saying no to everything and there's no fun. We've got to do a better job. But the way we start by doing a better job is not necessarily getting, you know, more tickets to the theme park. It's more understanding of the beauty of Jesus Christ and making it part of our life. Kids are going to mess up. If you're like me, you messed up somewhere in life. You made some issues that are there. The gospel redeems tarnished gifts. So even if your kids get caught up in something, even if you find out they've been messing around with pornography or other things that they shouldn't be messing around with, got themselves involved in difficult situations, not everybody's going to have the perfect unspoiled gift to offer. Matter of fact, very few will. But everyone has the opportunity through the gospel to present purity through the redemptive power that Christ brings to the ashes of sin. So we've got to acknowledge the ugliness of sin, but then we have to acknowledge that there's something better than that, that Jesus died for people like me, that Jesus died for all the things that I did wrong and all the other things that I have no clue what I did wrong. And he became sin. He who knew no sin became sin. So that when God looks at me, what does he see? The righteousness of Christ. Again, we have to be blown away by that. And if we are, then you can talk to your children, and even talk to yourselves and to each other about the beauty that you can bring purity to marriage. Even if you've been impure. And you know what? I agree with Tim. Find me a pure person. I'm still looking. And I'm older than he is. That's why Jesus had to die. If the gospel is not that integral, if that's not that central to our thinking, we are not going to be effective in winning the cultural battles. When I was in school, they used to use terms like, you know, girls got in trouble. We don't do that anymore now. You know, that's more of a rite of passage, and so we honor those particular girls who choose to have babies when they're 14, 15, 16, and 17, and our government chooses to reward them financially. I had a good friend who was lived in one of the housing projects in West Greenville, and so I was talking with him, and so how many other people here are married? Because it's rooms of 16, 16 apartments to a cluster. And he said, I'm the only one. I said, why is that? He said, well, if you're married, you have to pay $575 a month. If you're not married, you only got to pay $75 a month. So the guys don't get married. Girls don't get married. They have children. He mostly lives there all the time. They pay $75. My friend, who was honest and said he was married, pays $575 for the exact same apartment. It's what our government is rewarding. We're fighting against something which is huge, but it's winnable because Jesus is in the battle of winning. He doesn't get into a battle to lose. We have to have that. The gates of hell will not prevail against the onslaught of his church, even though to us it looks like things are kind of grim. Marriage, sexuality, and the gospel, those are the alternatives to a lust-driven culture's view of sex. Now, again, before we talk today, you might have heard those words and you say, well, yeah, that's nice, I believe those things. And what we're trying to do here in the conference, what Paul is doing, what Tim is doing, what I'm attempting to do, is to give you some real meat behind this so you understand, yeah, marriage, sexuality, and the gospel, that's what we need. Because our culture is where it needs not to be. Culture wants us to tell us that there's safe sex. And so we have this myth of safe sex. Safe sex outside of marriage is an oxymoron. But the culture tells us you could have safe, protected sex. Well, you may actually protect against disease or not having a pregnancy happen, but sex outside of marriage produces cultural chaos and havoc. Again, same topics: fear, doubt, insecurity, divorce, abortions, abuse, domestic violence. They've all increased since the sexual revolution of the 60s. You know what else has increased? The sale of antidepressant drugs. We're now in a multi-billion dollar industry of antidepressants. It's not the only reason to it, but the insecurity. Look, it's hard enough when you are married in this world. It's hard enough to give each other the love and support and sexual interaction that God calls us to. Take that outside of marriage. And people that see each other for a few days and they have a sexual relationship which is designed to unleash and bring about unbelievable relational strength. You take that outside the context of marriage, and that strength blows things sky high. The people who say, well, we just wanted to get in for some fun, now all of a sudden they get attached to the person that they had fun with, and the person they had fun with doesn't want any part of it. And they walk around in a state of discouragement and depression. So we see things like self-injury. You know, self-injury is not a whole lot different than penance. It's just a way of self-atonement. Not many people talk about it this way, but we do that. You know, Martin Luther, no disrespect to Mr. Luther, but, you know, he realized that knee replacements weren't going to be around for another 500 years, so he figured out climbing up those stairs on his knees was not a good idea. So he wound up buying into grace. A little bit edgy there. But the point is, penance doesn't do it. But you see these cultures all around the world where pain is something which is a part of penance. You see Buddhist monks who will sit like this for years till the fingernails grow out this side of their hand. You see various pain-inflicting devices in certain Catholic monasteries and other things where it's a big deal. People are trying to reach self-atonement. We've got kids that are involved in cutting who are trying to get free of the fact that they're being disobedient to God. Maybe not just sexually, maybe they're discouraged, maybe they're alienated. So they reach out to that. It's something that is so difficult to look at and to realize, why would this happen? Why are they doing this? But at root, if we're not trusting Christ, the door is wide open to anything. Most famous cutter I know of is Princess Diana. You would think that she had everything, except she didn't have a relationship with her husband, who was not interested in her, and after a while, she turned to cutting. You can read some interviews about it that talk about her desire. She was trying to find a better way to cope with things. Safe sex is not something that can happen anywhere except in the context of marriage. This myth of safe sex has led us to be very cavalier in what we do, so now we have redefined the family to be a combination of adults, any combination of adults, that includes a child. You all heard the term polyamory? Polyamory. It's a new psychological term. It's been around maybe 15 years. I've been reading about it. A number of our college campuses are promoting it. It means just, you know, break it apart. Poly meaning many. Amory meaning love, so many loves. So you could have a situation, several of our news magazines have highlighted this, where you could have two men, three women, whatever. As long as you stick a child in there, they're now a family. And they're now a distinct sociological unit. We can have same sex. They can't have children, but we can do surrogates or we can do other things that are going on and produce it that way. We want kids, and so we're not going to be limited by marriage. We're going to have kids any way we want them. That's what our culture is doing to us. We need to follow the example of Proverbs 7 that Tim mentioned. I'm going to read the same passage. He read it. And so you're going to get two versions of the same passage. I'm going to look at it from the standpoint of the father. What did the father do when he saw this train wreck happening in front of his home? Where this gullible kid, young man, is walking into the trap of this immoral woman. He saw it coming. He knew it was going to happen. What does he do? Close the windows? No, no, don't look at that. He opens the windows and calls his son over and says, look at this. And he describes it to him, precisely what is happening. He uses the language, talks about the way she came on to him, talking about how it's got to be safe. My husband's not at home. He went away on a journey. He had a bunch of money, so he's not coming back until at least the full moon. So, hey, we're good to go. I have paid my religious vows. I have done the God thing. And my bedroom is really cool. Let's go for it. And then as Tim read, he's like an ox going to the slaughter, or the deer in the snare, or the bird walking into the trap. Little did he know that he's walking into the bedroom of death. And the father tells his kid this. And he does it in such a way that is believable. If you tell your children this story, are they going to believe you, or they just think you're out trying to kill their fun? And trust me, they'll get there if we don't have that base of understanding how important and vital God is. So yeah, safe sex is a myth. Safe sex, which is something that we need to help ourselves and our children, help them understand that it doesn't exist. Another kind of a fun dinner topic conversation, self-pleasure. Just as it is with God and money in Matthew 6:19, self-pleasure and serving God don't work. You can't do both. Masturbation and pornography, and again, I'm talking primarily in this situation about what we're talking about with teenagers. In this situation, it feeds on self-pleasure, draws in self-pleasure. What it results is in doubt, loneliness, guilt, and enslavement. Ephesians 4:19 again says that the warning in the NIV 84 translates it this way, they have lost all sensitivity. Sensitivity means I care about you, correct? I'm interested in who you are. And given themselves over to sensuality, which means I care about me. And you see, in this culture, how many ads have you seen where the word sensual is used to sell a product? Anywhere from potato chips to cars. I like chocolate, but I don't like hearing chocolate that's decadent. But that somehow makes it more appealing. Sensuality has that public element to it, where we're wanting to do things that are being done in broad case, and it leads to enslavement. The passage at the end of Ephesians 4:19 says what this does is it entraps them and leads them into this greed and lust with a continual lust for more. You can't shut it down. You can't, as again Tim alluded, you can't look at the one picture and not come back to it. And soon the one picture doesn't cut it. And I've gone through this with young men, and as I talk to them, they start crying because I'm describing their life to them. They see the picture. Then they see another picture. And then they see another picture. And then they see the video. And then they see another video. And by the time that they're into the interactive part, they're so deep into this filth that they don't know how to get out, and they're persuaded God can never love them, and they are trash, and so all we can do is keep going. And I talk to mostly people in the church. This is happening in our churches. Maybe it's happening in this church. I don't know. But it would be unusual if it's not. We have to have this view of what God's called us to. 2 Samuel 13 and the story of Amnon and Tamar is the brilliant case study of what Ephesians 4:17-19 talks about when you buy into the world's way of thinking. Because Amnon wants Tamar. Tamar is Absalom's sister. Absalom is strikingly beautiful. Tamar is strikingly beautiful. So Amnon wants to have her. What's the problem with that? Amnon has enough sense to know that that's forbidden, so I can never have her. So instead of rejoicing in the fact, well, God is saving my bacon here by helping me see that that's going to be a bad thing, he goes and gets all discouraged and down and sad and mopes and whines. And this Jonadab character shows up. I make Jonadab the basic political insider, but we'll deal with that another time. Jonadab shows up and says, hey, you know, you're the crown prince of Israel. You're going to be the top dog one day. What are you upset about? Why should you be upset? So Amnon says, well, Tamar, I want Tamar, but I can't have her. And Jonah says, hey, no problem. We're going to get you a plan. The wrong, not Tim's plan, but another plan. And he makes this plan up, and he appeals it to David, and David is reeling from his own sexual sin and is not seeing Amnon's behavior for what it is, draws up this ludicrous plan for, you know, to get better, Amnon has to have the most beautiful woman in the city, probably, come and bring him bread. Hello? Anybody figure out that there's maybe some other kind of motive here? But David goes along with it. Tamar comes. Amnon proposes that he take her. She says, no. This is wrong. We can't do this in Israel. Ask David for my hand, and he will give me to you. Do you understand what she's saying? If you go talk to your father, you can have me physically for the rest of your life if you want. You can have all the sex you want. And Amnon says no. And he takes her and he rapes her. Because this type of enslavement demands that I get my needs satisfied no matter what the cost is. And then he devastates Tamar further by throwing her out. Winds up angering Absalom to the point where 2 years later, Absalom bides his time, kills Amnon, runs away, and starts a whole other sordid story where another political operator comes in, Joab, and makes things happen. But that, again, that's a different story. But the point here is the enslavement that happens. We have to help our kids through this. So that's the torment that Amnon's going through is because he's not looking at things God's way. And what Ephesians 4, 17 to 19 is laying out for us in clear fashion, in more abstract fashion, is the fact that if you go the world's way, it's never satisfied. It's dark, it's futile, and all it will do is produce more and more lust for the same. Your teenagers, if they're involved in some of these things, are not going to be happy campers, at least most of the time. They're going to feel isolated, withdrawn, combative. Instead of getting mad at them, take the time to be their friend and get into their life, not friend in the sense of co-equal friends, but the sense of showing act of grace and friendship and kindness to them, true parental love and care, and get into their life and say, what's going on here? And help them work it through. Too many people think that this distorted, corrupt view of sex will be solved by marriage. It won't be solved by marriage. Because what makes marriage work? Sensitivity, me caring for you. If you carry this baggage with you into marriage, what's going to be happening? There's no solution for that in marriage. So it continues. Again, I've counseled that way too many times. I've seen it. If you're about to do premarital counseling, or your kids are going to get premarital counseling, make sure the counselor covers this in detail. Better now than coming to see me 5 years later, or one of your counselors here. Here's a practical test that you can give to your kids and to yourself to find out if an activity is good. Would you pray for God's help to do it? Would you pray, dear God, please help me to have a great time viewing porn? And I tell that to kids. They laugh out loud. Of course I never asked God to do that. Lord, would you help me have a good time masturbating? Would you help me have a good time messing around with my girlfriend? Would you help me having a good time just having thoughts of fantasy and lust and desire? We never pray a prayer like that. Why? Because we know God doesn't want it. Now, we've got some pretty strange people in the society that are trying to link all this stuff to some strange type of God that we don't know anything about. But if we're talking about the Bible's God, such a prayer would be ridiculous. That's a window to be able to make contact with your kids. It's a fantastic window. If you can't pray for it, why would you do it? Because God doesn't matter, that's why. We've got to be in the business of having God matter. Faith is neither is it a carrot out there, you know, in terms of getting out of enslavement. It's not redemption from something for the long lost future. It's about right now. It means redemption, repentance, and trust flow from a heart given over to the gospel. So I don't have to wait 15 years to find out if God's going to be faithful. I can start experiencing his faithfulness right now. Teach your kids the difference between repentance and regret. 2 Corinthians 7:10, we don't have time to get into it, but talks about regret leads to death, repentance leads to life. Find out what the difference is. Preparing for marriage is positive. It's more than just saying no to sin. God is not dangling a carrot out there that in the future, it'll be okay. What God is saying is that knowing Christ now is of huge value. A relationship with Jesus Christ, where he is honored. When you wake up every day thinking that Ephesians 2:10 says that there are good works that God has prepared for me to do, Lord, help me to find them and do them so I can bring honor to Christ. If that's not on your hearts, it's not going to be in your kids' hearts, at least from a parental standpoint. Knowing Christ now is of huge value. You've got to be blown away by the gospel. And that's the key element to addressing all these issues that we're talking about. It's huge. Faith is something that is for now. It builds us now. It encourages us now. So everyday talk about sex and marriage, summing up, it follows the model of the dad in Proverbs 7 who is involved and engaged, doing the things that Tim is calling you to do, who is being prepared, and who is equipping his children to do what the right thing is. Your talk must be authentic. It must demonstrate what repentance looks like. What do I mean by that? Have you ever messed up as a parent? I have. You know what your kids are not expecting you to say? When I was struggling with pornography, I came to realize what a deep, dark trail that was, and the Lord blessed me. Looked at that stuff in college, which was several millennia ago, trust me. I have those images today, what I saw 50 years ago. And they are as fresh and as vibrant as they were then. The difference is that I know that those things represent hate. I know those things represent a desire to consume my soul. And I know that those things are something that I have to hate and go after. And just ignore. If I held out the Playmate of the Month here. By the way, Playboy has determined it's not a wise thing to get rid of nudity, so they're bringing it back. They tried it for a year, couldn't handle it. So I'm holding out Playmate of the Month here, and this person is supposed to look attractive by the world standards. But then I start telling you that this person in this picture is an axe murderess. She's a cannibal. She carries every sexually transmitted disease known to man, and she excels in torture. Now how good does she look? Not so good at all. What's changed? Picture hasn't changed. Your perception of it has changed. That's where you want to go to war with. You want to change that perception to say this is not what it appears to be. What is Satan in the business of doing? Lying. He lied to Eve. He's lying to you. He's lying to the culture. He's lying to your children. Call it for what it is. Tell your children about how God has rescued you through repentance. That's how you demonstrate what repentance looks like. Your talk must be compelling and relevant. Not distant, not an ordeal, but you have to have personal energy. You have to have something in that fight that is yours, and it's got to touch where they are. You have to know your kids well enough to know the kind of things they're struggling with. If you don't know the things you're struggling with day to day, what they're looking at, and if you don't know what their locker room is like, then find out. Not so you can scold them, but so you can help rescue them. Your heart must value the Bible's truth about sex and marriage. Sounds like it's an easy statement. But it's not. Inventory time. If you're not there, get there. And when you're dealing with your kids, most of all, you've got to be driven by a heart of compassion. Not by a heart that says, when are you going to stop breaking the rules? I told you shouldn't be doing that. See, look what happened. You've got to do more than that. And maybe the most important lesson you can have as a parent, especially for teenagers, you've got to be a refuge before you can be a resource. You've got to be someone your kids trust. You've got to be someone that your kids know that you care about them, that you care about God, but that you also care about them. You can't just say, do this, do that, do the other thing. When you get to teenage years and even beyond, you have to create the climate where your kids are going to come to you. You had the chance earlier on when they were younger. Now they're older. You can't force it in that way. You've got to make things appealing so your kids want to come to you. Dad, help me. Have my 19-year-old son say that to me. And he knew the right stuff. But through a lot of issues, hassles, and struggles, it got to the point, because of the grace of God, that he was able to come to me. Say, Dad, help me with this. And we got somewhere. You've got to be a refuge before you can be a resource. It takes a lot of courage, a lot of faith, a lot of trust. As we say goodbye here to the sunset, I had to throw in one of my pictures. I just encourage you to seek God. Know the beauty of the gospel. Value the person of Jesus Christ. And then talk about what God says about sex and marriage. That's what he's called us to. Again, thank you for your attention.